going to spend the hour on dyslexia and what that means, how debilitating it can be for those learning to read, and how it can be even worse for those for whom it goes undiagnosed. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we're going to spend the hour talking about this and invite you to participate at 1-800-642-1234. I was talking about this yesterday with a friend, and we both remembered kids from our classroom way back when who would rather act out or get kicked out of class altogether than have to read out loud. You know, if we only knew then what we're arguably just beginning to better understand now. Our guest this morning is the mother of two boys with dyslexia. She recently wrote the book, One in Five, Fighting for Our Dyslexic Kids, which includes the stories of 20 parents of children with dyslexia and the struggles they went through to get treatment. Mickey Boas, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
Let's begin with what dyslexia is. How do you define it?
Yes. In simple terms, it's a learning disability that produces an unexpected difficulty in reading for those who have an intelligence level that's much higher to read. And interesting enough, like you mentioned in the beginning of the show, it's a neurobiological disorder. And if one parent is dyslexic, your child has a 50% chance of having it as well. And most parents aren't even diagnosed until they start seeing these difficulties in their child. So it's simply a different way that the brain is wired to process language.
Okay. And that makes sense. But it's different than what I think I traditionally thought about dyslexia, is how words or letters get rearranged on a page. But it really is just how we perceive, right?
Yes. It's just a different wiring in how you take in language. And so what's critical for schools and parents to understand is that you need to give your child a multi-sensory based learning system that gives you many different touch points to learn how to take in language. So to your point, it's a misconception that dyslexia is just, you know, reversing B's and D's.
Yeah, thank you so much. And you're the mother of two dyslexic school-aged boys. And, you know, part of your book, One in Five, is about the struggle to try to get treatment. And when you talk about dyslexia, tell us about this path of getting your sons what they need.
Yeah. So I have an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old. And for my 11-year-old, my oldest son, it took me 4 years, 4 lawyers, and 4 schools to get him a formal diagnosis and the support that's mandated by law. And when I learned that so many other parents were struggling with this, that 1 in 5 children have dyslexia, I decided to quit my job, write this book, and try to help other parents get quicker results, because we're really living in a national education crisis, because children aren't diagnosed until too lately at 10. The average child should be reading by 7. So you're missing those critical years needed in order to support your child in the way that their brain learns.
So how do you begin to diagnose dyslexia?
That's a good question. So it's interesting, but you can accurately diagnose dyslexia at 5, and you can begin to see warning signs around 3. So for example, at 15 months of age, your child should be saying their first phrases. Speech is a typical marker of dyslexia. Until the age of 2, if they haven't learned their alphabets or remembering their names, having difficulty remembering nursery rhymes, you should have a very open and honest conversation with your pediatrician. So the average well visit for a pediatrician in the U.S., 1/3 of visits are under 10 minutes. So the number one red flag you must bring up to your pediatrician, and it will help you so much, is if you say that there's a family history of dyslexia. And if you're not sure if your partner has struggled, have them take one of the tests on the International Dyslexia Association of Signs of Dyslexia, and the results will be shocking.
Yes, because the title of your book is shocking, Mickey Boas. 1 in 5. Yeah. It's a reference to how many people are believed to have dyslexia. And if that's true, that means 20% of the population has a learning disability, and a lion's share of that is undiagnosed. How did 1 in 5, Mickey?
Yeah. So in 1983, Dr. Sally Shaywitz with Yale University began tracking over 400 kindergartners picked at random. And she's actually still studying them to this day, but the study covers 20 years. And the research showed that 1 in 5 children have dyslexia. And so, yes, those numbers are very shocking. And what's more shocking is that the education system has never been built to support them. The laws that were passed to help children with disabilities in 1975 has really, really never lived up to his promises, which is why we're in the crisis we're in today.
So it almost sounds to me as though if you are concerned about your child's learning development, that you would want to actually ask the parents to look at their learning development first to find out if perhaps there could be a genetic component.
Yes, that's one of the first things you should do. You can also look for, you know, the 6 early literacy milestones, such as the ability to manipulate sounds and language, letter names, vocabulary. But yeah, those are some of the early things that you can do.
Mm-hmm. Mickey Boas is the mother of 2 boys with dyslexia. She wrote the book 1 in 5, Fighting for Our Dyslexic Kids. And if you've got a story to tell, we've got the time to share it this morning. We're talking about this all hour at 1-800-642-1234. Do you think students with dyslexia are going to be able to get what they need through virtual learning? Now that the classroom has changed, how does that change the experience for those who are learning diverse? And did you know that dyslexia was genetic? 1-800-642-1234. And Mickey, your book tells the stories of you along with 19 other parents of dyslexic children. Why did you want to reach out to other parents for their stories?
Yes, because while I live in Jersey City, this is not about me and my story. Education law is regulated at a state and local level, and I wanted to show that this is a national education crisis. And so that's why I went across the country and interviewed over 19 women, because by showing and telling their stories, I believe, Lee, that's how we create change, to show that these outrageous obstacles we have to face, such as underfunding, early intervention, and teacher training is rampant across the nation. And if a child is not reading by the 3rd grade, they are 4 times more likely to drop out. And those statistics are something that is not acceptable.
Yeah. Emotionally, what's it like? You talk about a 4-year struggle, 4 lawyers, 4 schools. At some point you just kept going. What kept you going?
I mean, one night I came home and my son told me that he was called the Statue of Liberty for holding his hand up too long. Can you imagine as a parent being told that your child isn't getting the help they need and being bullied and called that? And we saw it. Typically what happens is children are not diagnosed until they're 2.5 years behind. It's called the discrepancy model. And what happens is if you let a child wait that long, their self-esteem goes down. They think they're stupid. They don't want to go to school. They drop out. 85% of the juvenile prison population cannot read. And I was not about to let that happen to my child.
Whoa, there seems to be a correlation there, Mickey.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 35% of entrepreneurs that you mentioned at the top of your show have dyslexia, because it's something that is creative. You have to find unique ways around your strength to succeed. And as you start to read slowly in class, you're considered stupid. And if you can't keep up, but if you're given the right tools, you can succeed. And, a Made by Dyslexia study showed that 70% of those who were able to succeed had someone in their corner.
Not just succeed, but also be able to perceive things in ways that folks who would be with average perception would never be able to see the world. It's perhaps like a superpower. That might be for after 8:30. Mickey Boas is our guest. She's the author of 1 in 5, Fighting for Our Dyslexic Kids, which includes the stories of 19 parents and hers of children with dyslexia and the struggles they went through to get treatment. Be interested in hearing from your stories this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Have you struggled to get your dyslexic child the support they need in school? You can email us, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. Mickey Boas is a mom, also an author. The book is 1 in 5, Fighting for Our Dyslexic Kids, and we spend the hour this morning talking about just that with you and our guests at 1-800-642-1234. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Do you know a friend or a family member who's been diagnosed with dyslexia? What do they say about how they learn to read. Have you overcome dyslexia in your own life, or are you the parent of a child diagnosed with dyslexia? Let us know, 1-800-642-1234. And Mickey, you talk about your two boys, aged 11 and 8. How are they doing today?
They're doing great, actually. After we decided to pull my oldest son out in the second grade and put him in a private school for language-based learning difficulties, and he's been thriving ever since he's been there, so he's in good shape. My youngest son, he is getting the support he needs, but that also took me another two-year battle. It was like a post-traumatic stress living in Groundhog's Day. But I really feel that if special education is fundedly, it costs twice as much to educate my children as it does neurotypical children, that most of these problems wouldn't exist. But the federal government has not funded it since it was passed. It's only ever been funded at 15%. So it puts a great state and local burden to ask the schools to make up that difference, which creates drama around early intervention and teacher training. And so my hope is that your audience is able to, you know, speak to their Congress people in the November elections and really talk about the stories that affect them.
Well, there's the cost of educating, but you also brought up before the break the cost or the connection, the correlation between learning disabilities and our people in the incarceration. So yep. It seems like there's opportunity costs, and we just have to decide where our money lies. But
average high school dropout is $292,000 cost to society. So there's a great cost, correct?
Yeah. So when we talk about treatment, Mickey Boas, how is dyslexia treated today?
Yes. So, I mean, how is it really treated, or how should it be treated?
Well, show me the discrepancy between the two as you see it.
Yes. So a special education teacher, if you're lucky enough to get your child diagnosed late, so my child was diagnosed and only given 30 minutes a week of the reading support he needed. So imagine if you can't see and you're told that you can only put on your glasses for 30 minutes a week. So most special education teachers are being asked to teach 13 different types of disability, and none are trained. Only 4 out of 10 teacher training programs teach multisensory instruction. And what that is it's a way to engage more than one sense at a time using sight, hearing, movement, and touch, because again, dyslexia is a language-based disability, and so you need to give the information in ways that children can process it. And that's very rare that happens in schools today because the teachers aren't trained.
Well, let's go to Angela in Sheboygan, who has a story. And Angela, you're on the Ideas Network. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, my son Mario, who is a third grader, in second grade, his teacher, who is extremely thorough, she kept telling me something's not right. He needs help. He's not able to do what he needs to do every day. He's slow processing. And I was actually able to go into the classroom like twice a week. And I just was observing her and kind of overjudging her. And it wasn't her. It was me and my son, like, realizing that we needed to do something. So we did. We actually had been noted that he had a conversion problem. It's called conversion deficiency. And they say when your eyes can't converge an image or have that equal sight process to look at the letters and visually see them straight across on a line, that quite often that one problem can also be linked to the second one, which is dyslexia. So that's what we ended up with. We had the two together, and he never wanted to read. He was always angry, always fighting, always unhappy, barely wanted to go to school. We finally figured it out. During coronavirus, it was even twice as hard because virtually learning was not easy. So we worked with a person who taught that same method with sight, and touch and taste, kind of verbally, like looking at things 3 times over the internet, virtually. She helped him over this past 6 months, but now we're back to what do we do now, you know? But yeah, we're really very grateful.
Angela, I very much appreciate your story, and Mickey, she's far from alone.
Yeah, no, I mean, congratulations on fighting and getting Mario the support he needs. You know, I've seen some parents virtually, you know, you get webcams so that teachers can see how they're writing on paper. I've seen parents downloading Orton Gillingham curriculum and trying to teach it themselves. We're not in an ideal moment, but I'm really glad that you're keeping an eye and pushing forward in this difficult time.
Let's go to Christine in Kenosha. Christine, you're on the Ideas Network. Good morning.
Good morning. I am a physician with an MBA, and I didn't realize I had dyslexia until I was well into maybe my first or second year of med school. And I don't think I was diagnosed because I have a brother who has much more significant learning disabilities. So focus, you know, when we were in school, I was able to manage. But what I noticed, and I thought was an interesting way to handle it, when I was in med school and I had such a volume of material that I had to remember, I couldn't read it. And I couldn't auditory process either. You know, I couldn't take my classroom notes and absorb it like everyone else did. So I had to take my own notes. And then in the evening, I rearranged my notes. I rewrote my notes. And that seemed to be really helpful in my memory capacity and my learning capacity. I transposed numbers and letters. But that wasn't such a big deal. I was a slow learner. But I think the process of rewriting my notes in a way that made sense to me allowed me to study, and that really became so obvious to me that I studied different than the rest of my friends because it was the first time I really did group learning. And I think I'm wondering if that might help other people as they with dyslexia.
Doctor, thank you so much.
Mickey? Yeah, I mean, that's a common, most people with dyslexia, 40% have also ADHD and what's called executive functioning and low working memory. So it does help if you can sequence out your information. Most dyslexic children have a problem following tire shoes, get your backpack, get out the door. So if you can break those down into small chunks, it helps with memory and processing.
Jennifer in Bristol, you are on the Ideas Network with Mickey Boas.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What do you have?
I grew up as an undiagnosed dyslexic person, kind of struggled through school. When my oldest son was about 5, I noticed him having similar difficulties. And I, through a series of events, ended up finding somebody who did vision therapy with him. And within 3 months, his dyslexic tendencies improved dramatically. He was able to catch a ball. He was able to read letters and numbers in the proper sequence. He actually started trying to write for the first time, which he would never sit and do before. I just wonder why there aren't more people advocating for vision therapy.
Jennifer, the question I have for you is you know, what was the change in how your son felt about himself?
Oh, dramatic. He had confidence for the first time. Like, he wanted to play with the other kids on the playground. He wanted to explore books. Like, there is a whole world that opened for him when we went through vision therapy. It was just dramatic.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. More vision therapy, Mickey?
So vision therapy is definitely one thing that can help. And as your caller mentioned, 2/3 of people with learning disabilities don't get help or what they need. But if it's found early and given the support like vision therapy or early intervention, 92% of those children can be reading on grade level. So please reach out to your local Decoding Dyslexia and other groups to find local resources that can help.
Yeah. So when I'm hearing this morning, and with Jennifer talking about being undiagnosed until she was an adult, that parents should certainly test their own learning abilities before they start thinking about their child, considering the genetic component of dyslexia. With a few minutes we have left here, Mickey, I'd like to know from you, for parents with concerns, where can they turn? Where are the resources available?
Yeah, so locally, I mean, the Decoding Dyslexia in Wisconsin has just passed a law with your governor in March on making a Decoding Dyslexia guidebook to help you understand the rules. So please go to your local group, Facebook, to find that. Please talk to your local congresspeople about funding IDEA. Have those open and honest conversations with your teachers as back to school starts, letting them know how you're, what you're concerned about. And it's within your rights to have them screened and diagnosed. So please don't let that get in the way as we're in these tough times.
Would it be fair if anybody brings up the cost to say it'd be more expensive not to?
Oh, it's way more expensive not to. And right now, with all the online resources we have, there's webinars, there's, it takes the time and resources from parents, and we are all overstressed and we don't need any more other things, but we have to keep literacy in our sights, because if not, it has a great effect on our children's self-esteem and society.
Mickey Boas, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Lee.
Mick is the author of 1 in 5, Fighting for Our Dyslexic Kids. It includes the stories of 20 parents of children with dyslexia and the struggles they went through to get treatment. Up next is news. Then we'll continue our conversation about dyslexia with you and how we can help those diagnosed with it as we talk with the author of Dr. Dyslexia Dude graphic novels. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So are there superheroes in real life? I'm betting there are. They probably just don't wear a costume. Imagine capes and cod pieces are for the comic books, but I also imagine there are heroes, if you're willing to look. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Kate Archer Kent, and our conversation about dyslexia through this hour continues with an introduction to a superhero with dyslexia. What question might you have for them at 1-800-642-1234? Email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Sean Robinson, who overcame dyslexia in his own life, is an educator and author who writes the graphic novels Dr. Dyslexia Dude about an African-American superhero with dyslexia. Sean, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And thank you for creating Dr. Dyslexia Dude. Give us a little idea about your journey, though, Sean. Tell us about how you came to understand your diagnosis of dyslexia.
Yes, I can do that. First, I just want to give a shout out to my wife, Ashira Robinson, because she wasn't able to be here today, but she's also a big contributor to this book, too. So I wanted to make sure I give proper respect to my wife. My experience with dyslexia, I wasn't diagnosed till I was 18 years old. I was angry, bitter at the world, unsure about myself, didn't really have any focus or any motivation to learn, until I had a professor by the name of Dr. Robert T. Nash, who diagnosed me at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. And he pretty much told me that I was failed by the system, and that I had a lot of talent and I had a lot of gifts inside of me. And that in order for me to really blossom into my gifts, that I would have to work hard and learn to read. And once he taught me how to read, I just never looked back, and I started loving to learn. I started loving to read and write, and so I really think about, you know, people in my life who helped me, and Dr. Nash was my superhero. He not only diagnosed me, but gave me hope to be where I'm at today, and so it wasn't for him and the people before him and the ones who helped me, I wouldn't be where I'm at today. So I'm very thankful for the opportunity.
And you know, what we've heard, Sean, over the first half hour of talking about dyslexia is much the same story as yours, is that, you know, when before the diagnosis, there is a certain amount of rage. There is just a, you know, the world doesn't work for you, or it just doesn't, you don't fit in it. After the diagnosis, yes. Your words are, you know, your love, and it opens up, and there's and the world, it's like life starts at the diagnosis.
Yes, it's that's, you know, I feel like I was reborn again. You know, I was rejuvenated. I was felt like a eagle that was able to soar, you know, for my predecessor, Dr. Nash. So it's really, I was angry. I got kicked out of high school and went to a term of high school for 2 years. I was on a behavior management plan. I had some really great teachers in high school. I love them to death. But I just didn't have the resources, and the teachers weren't really trained to provide me the instruction I needed in reading.
And so what was college like then, Sean? I'd be curious, is that where you met Dr. Nash, in college, or was that still in high school?
That was high school when he diagnosed me, and then after I graduated, I started his program. It was an intensive 6 to 8 week remedial program for college-age adults with dyslexia at UW Oshkosh. And it was hard. Like, I wanted to give up. You know, I thought, you know, I had, you know, depression. Just, it was just a different experience. But I had people who just loved me and taught me, you know, the basics, linguistics, phonemes, graphemes, decoding, encoding, and taught me how to use a dictionary. And then from that point on, I just started to practice and apply it, you know. And so it took me 6 years to get my undergrad degree because I had to kind of learn everything I missed through K-12, you know, math, writing, all the basic fundamentals that you learn. So I had to learn that plus my college material, which, you know, wasn't easy, but I had to do what I had to do if I wanted to be successful for myself. And so it just took me 6 long years.
And, but then you went further and you obtained a PhD. And again, it underscores this story that ends up becoming Dr. Dyslexia Dude, that understanding your learning diversity can become an asset, can become a superpower.
Yes, yes. I mean, yeah, because it took me 5 years to get my master's at DePaul University because I was still having a difficult time with my academics. And then after I finished my master's, I went on for a PhD, and I was in my PhD program for 7 years. So I was in school 18 plus years after high school.
Yeah, but as you said, you basically caught up K through 12 within there along the way and ended up with your PhD when it was all said and done, and then continued from there. Sean Robinson is our guest. He overcame dyslexia in his own life. He is the educator and author who writes the graphic novels Dr. Dyslexia Dude about an African-American superhero with dyslexia. How did this all start for you, Sean? And again, it sounds like a continuation of Dr. Nash's diagnosis of you that started this, but then evolves into a graphic novel for children to read of any age or enjoy. How did Dr. Dyslexia Dude come to life?
You know, as a scholar, practitioner, one of the things, you know, is that a lot of times we write for peer-reviewed journals and articles, and parents and teachers are not going to read those, and kids. So one day I looked at my wife, I said, hey, I have an idea. I want to write a kid's book. I don't know how it's going to work out. Don't know, you know, how people are going to receive it. And we wrote our first one and it took off, and then we wrote our second one. And I just didn't think it was going to have the impact it had. And really the idea behind it was just to give kids hope, you know, let them see themselves in the sense of a superhero and, you know, overcoming their own odds. And kids need that these days, particularly with the, you know, COVID and the way, the world's turning, you know, so kids just need hope, and families, parents need hope too. And so that was the big thing, is just give people hope.
Well, and it's a vibrant comic book. It brings the Dr. Dyslexia Dude to life. And part of this is as you mentioned, Nchira Robinson, your wife, but also the illustrator, Brandon Hadnot Walker, who's the illustrator for Dr. Dyslexia Dude. And here's what he had to say about you, Sean.
Maybe especially if they identify with the struggles that Sean's character is going through, that they could feel a little bit more confident and flip their condition on its head that made them feel really negative about themselves, but now they can feel positive and they can feel like they can fight. They too can feel like a superhero.
Part of your superpower in this graphic novel is Brandon Hadnot Walker. It's beautiful artwork.
Listen, a talented artist, talented human being, beautiful soul, and he put a lot of time and effort into doing this. And, you know, we didn't expect this type, but he just, you know, as an artist, he just kind of took it and ran with it. And we were very fortunate to have this opportunity to work with him.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And where can folks get their copy of Dr. Dyslexia Dude?
On our website, drdyslexiadude.com. And has blogs on there too, and testimonials from readers, and some things we've done, you know, across the country and even international too.
Let's go back to the phones this morning at 1-800-642-1234 as we're spending this hour talking about dyslexia and the different ways in which we learn. Mary in Northern Wisconsin, you're on the Ideas Network. Good morning.
Yes. Hello. I wanted to talk about my son. He's 27 now, but he always had trouble reading from K kindergarten through fifth grade. I went to lots of conferences, and I found a summer reading program. He went to the local college, went there every summer, and then in not till high school, he worked with a counselor, and she diagnosed him that he may have dyslexia. Worked with him a couple hours a week. He must have figured it out, and he graduated, and he was great in calculus, and now he is a mechanical engineer. So
you got to be proud.
I am.
Yeah, and I very much appreciate your story, Mary. And it, I think it helps to share stories like your son's, because it helps explain for some, when you see that angry child, perhaps some understanding of what's going on there. Thank you so much for your story. And Sean, it's a lot like yours.
Oh, yes. You know, those testimonies are powerful. I mean, you know, kids have full potential, and even adults have potential. And sometimes we have to go through these trials and tribulations to find them. But it'd be a lot easier if at a younger age, teachers had the tools to provide these students, you know, the access to literacy, you know, and a free and appropriate education. So parents don't have to dish out a lot of money for private tutoring, or have to go through the psychological toll of knowing if their kid is going to be able to read or not. That's a lot. And so,
yeah. And we share stories of Mary's son, and we share your story, Sean, and Dr. Dyslexia Dude, because it helps explain everybody else's story to some degree and in some way. And so you can get Dr. Dyslexia Dude online from the website, and you can get to that website through ours at WPR.org/mornings. Sean, when's the next Dr. Dyslexia Dude coming out?
We're working on 3 and 4 right now, so
okay.
I don't have a timeline. They do take a while to write them and then to illustrate them too, so probably 6 months to a year.
Yeah, and you're putting a lot of your education and what you've learned through your PhD program and your research. This is all part of Dr. Dyslexia Dude today.
Yeah, and we're also, I'm not going to share too much, but we're making some animations and some other.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, some
hold it right
platform.
There. I'm sorry, Sean. We got to take a break, but Sean Robinson's our guest. He's overcome dyslexia in his own life. He writes the graphic novels Dr. Dyslexia Dude, which you can get online now, or about an African-American superhero with dyslexia. He also teaches at Madison College and works with UW-Madison's WeLab. I'm Lee Rayburn, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Understanding how we understand each other. We've dedicated this hour to talking about dyslexia and what we all might learn from it. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn, and if you have stories to share, then thanks to those who have shared already. We've still got time for yours at 1-800-642-1234. You can always email ideas@WPR.org. We're also up on the Twitter at WPR Mornings. Our guest is Sean Robinson, who overcame dyslexia and also writes the graphic novels Dr. Dyslexia Dude, about an African-American superhero with dyslexia. Let's go back to the phones and your questions and stories this morning. Will in Madison, you're on the Ideas Network.
Hi, excuse me. Good morning, Dr. Robinson. I'm really glad you're on this morning talking about this, your wonderful work. My question is, so as you may know, I'm a white person with dyslexia and have grown up and learned that and over, you know, come that process. But I think about this, as you may know, in the context of COVID and Black Lives Matter, the era that we're in. When you think about dyslexia and the journey differences of people with dyslexia, the African-American community, what do you hope that white folks who have dyslexia understand the similarities and yet the disparities, the differences of the experience that would be important for folks to understand?
Sean, Will, thank you.
Thank you, Will. You know, dyslexia doesn't really have any color. You know, every kid has dyslexia. unfortunately, the part is if you're part of the bottom half and come from a low SES background, the chances of likelihood of you getting diagnosed are slim.
Is and that then, socioeconomic SES? Yes, socioeconomic?
Yes. And so, but then if you throw culture on it, you know, African-American boys in particular are two or three more times likely to be identified as having a behavioral or emotional disorder. So then it becomes a cultural issue where teachers may or may not understand the values of the students that they come from, you know, their capital, their
Sean, would you have been diagnosed with a behavioral disorder before Dr. Nash diagnosed you with dyslexia?
Yes, I had my IEP was all behavioral from pretty much pre-elementary, pre-K all the way through high school.
So when we're talking about racial bias as it exists, you can't ignore the diagnosis and treatment in medicine, can you?
No, because mostly African-American boys are identified as having behavioral disabilities. And so that takes away from their instruction in reading. And again, that sets them up for the prison, the pipeline system for, you know, suspensions, expulsions, and not really receiving a fair and appropriate education.
Sean, our first guest, Mickey Boas, said we've got to be able to diagnosis. We've got to be able to incorporate it into our education. And in order to do any of that, we're going to have to fund it. Is this a funding issue?
Funding and probably political, too.
Sean, enough said. You are teaching reading right now. In addition to your graphic novels, you're also a faculty member at Madison College, where you'll be teaching adult students to read this fall. I have to imagine I can't imagine much more rewarding work than this, Sean. Yes. And tell me a little bit about this experience and what it's like for your students and what it's like for you.
Well, I just started. My first class was on Monday.
Oh, wow.
Yep, and so I think the biggest challenge of any educator online is how to keep students engaged, right, and keep their attention and, you know, have them be active participants in the learning process, particularly when students have had not positive experiences in school before. So this is a learning curve for not just them, but for myself, and so I've made that clear to the students I work with and my colleagues that we're all listening together. You know, we have to be patient with each other. It's a learning curve. But if we work together at this, we can be successful. It takes a village. And so that's what I've tried to instill in my communication with the students this first week so far.
Do many of them have a dyslexia diagnosis, Sean?
I can't say that for sure. But I want to make an assumption that some may have a learning disability in the math, writing, or reading. And so I look forward to having these conversations and helping them, you know, navigate their own academic space.
How do you, as an adult, at a certain point, you'd imagine you would just forego learning reading altogether. But how do adults overcome illiteracy? What is your technique for teaching adults with dyslexia to read? Where do you start, Sean?
It's the same place I started when Dr. Nash taught me. He taught me how to use a dictionary and taught me how to diacritically mark words and understand phonemes and graphemes, letter sound connections, and really just help me know how to take words apart and put them together. And so having that understanding of phonemic awareness and understanding of our language structure, it's like the foundation.
Not to assume your age here, but was your dictionary at the time, it was a hard copy. I imagine it was something you carried around in physical, but now you could type any word into Google and you should be able to find a dictionary source for it. Has online provided some opportunities for different avenues of learning, Sean?
Oh, yes, of course. I think it's gonna, and particularly within the context of COVID, someone's gonna force people to use technology as a tool for learning. It can't supplement face-to-face instruction, but it can be a tool to help students who might need extra support.
You've also worked to understand the intersection of race and dyslexia, as Will has brought up. What more do we know about this, and what more can we do?
I think just bring awareness to it and really not making assumptions about students and really providing them the right diagnosis, you know, and assessments at an early age. That's where it starts. You know, teacher training, Providing the teachers with the tools to understand the students, where they come from, their family values, because the assessments only show a little bit about the students, you know, particularly with their deficits. But as we know, those test scores don't always predict students' success. Like when I graduated my PhD, I got my last test, and it showed that anything over the grade of 13 would be difficult for me. But I have a PhD, so.
So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, so I just think that, you know, people really have to understand the students and appreciate them and listen to them and really love on them. I mean, I love students like I love my own kids. So we just got to, you know, provide teachers with the proper training. And that's such a debate right now in Wisconsin, across the country.
Yeah, teacher training. In fact, Sean, we have an email here from Jan from Milton who writes this. I'm a retired learning disabled teacher who did not get the proper education at UW-Whitewater to teach children who had difficulty learning to read. I found the answer in a class sponsored by IDA, the International Dyslexia Association, says Jan from Milton. She goes on to say that Wisconsin has tried to pass laws to correct this problem, but that doesn't work because the teachers need to be trained. She says it's up to our colleges to do this. Are we seeing this in the education field? Are we adapting to dyslexia? And, you know, Sean, as we talk about it, I think about it the same way we adapted to understanding autism, not as a binary on and off, but rather as a spectrum, that dyslexia isn't this rearranging of words, but is a learning disability that can not just be overcome, but as you point out, can become a superpower. How much of this will have to do with the education of teaching people how to teach people with dyslexia?
100%. Yeah. But unfortunately, we have politics that get in the way, and at the end of the day, kids' lives are destroyed, and that's really, you know, our future, our kids, you know. And the more we resist and argue among each other as adults, you know, and different professionals who have different philosophical beliefs, you know, we're time is an enemy right now. And, I mean, with COVID and just the change.
And what we've seen all hour are stories, including yours, where kids who at one point could be considered acting out or could even be, you know, called dumb, were actually just adapting to the world, learning how to understand it. And once they did get the diagnosis and the treatment they need, they didn't just overcome. They became Dr. Dyslexia Dude.
Yes, yes. Kids just need to have hope, right? They need to have the right instruction and meet them where they're at and, you know, give them a little push, you know. Let them know that it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay to fail. But you just got to keep fighting like the little train. Choo-choo. You know, you keep going. I mean,
get yourself up, dust yourself off, and start all over again. Sean Robinson, thank you so much.
Welcome.
Sean Robinson is the writer behind Dr. Dyslexia Dude, the series of graphic novels, along with his wife and Shira Robinson, and the illustrator. Got to get his name in here. Brandon Hadnot Walker, Dr. Dyslexia Dude. Thank you for the discussion this hour, and certainly it continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and coming up, it's 1A with Jen White as they take a look today at who the armed civilians are in Kenosha, where they came from, and where their allegiance lies. You're listening to The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network.